is going to be on appellate arbitration, and Donna will very shortly give you a little bit more background on the substance. My task is on behalf of CPR to welcome you all and to introduce the presenters. The presenters today are going to be Scott Donahue, who is a CPR mediator and arbitrator in commercial and IP matters. He is a member of a number of other panels, and his full biography can be found at TZMM.com. Hopefully he can't be found at TMZ.
It could be found at www.scottdonahue.com.
Oh, that's even better. Judge Malonis is a member of Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman and is formerly a justice of the Appellate Division, Supreme Court, First Department, and the Chief Administrative Judge of the New York State Court. Judge Joseph Morris is a member of the law firm of Gable and Gottwell and former Chief Judge of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Oklahoma, and prior to that had an in-house corporate career. Richard Pratt is the former U.S. Judge for the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Special Counsel Darrell Fritz and the Honorable William Webster is the former director of the CIA and the FBI and a former judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth. All of the panelists have served as appellate arbitrators, and with that I turn it over to Scott.
Thank you, Elena. Good afternoon, everyone. I have been asked to be on this panel with these illustrious judges. I'm not quite sure how I have recently done an appellate arbitration as an appeal arbitrator for CPR. There are a number of questions, of course, that arise when we think about arbitration and an appeal procedure, and that is, it's the generally held view that arbitration should be a speedy and inexpensive process, and why are we even talking about adding another layer to that process, an appeal of the underlying arbitration award, and the delay and extra time and expense that entails. And so today we're going to talk with you and hopefully get your ideas on the subject as well. But we're going to hear from our illustrious panelists as to their experiences, and I want to direct particular questions to each of them, and as to their experiences in the appellate arbitration process. I also would, in the recent editions of the Alternatives publication from CPR, Ray Bender, an arbitrator who I've had the good fortune to serve on a panel with, has an excellent two-part article on appellate arbitration, and I commit it to you. He gives his thoughts on why some people want to engage in this process. And that leads me to direct my first question to Judge Morris, who I had the great honor of serving on a panel that he chaired recently in Chicago. And Judge, I wanted to ask you, why an appellate process? Why are we doing this to arbitration?
Well, it seems to me that one possible reason is suggested by the survey which was conducted by CPR, Pepperdine, and Cornell, and it went to Fortune 1000 companies, and it was directed to the office of the general counsel of each of those companies. And they were asked in the survey, among other things, why there had been a sharp decline in the use of arbitration and what they objected to. And it turned out that a substantial 52% objected on the grounds that an award by an arbitration panel was too difficult to appeal. And 41% objected on the grounds that it was too difficult to appeal in the employment area, and 52% in the corporate and commercial area. And that, to me, suggested that there were at least some cases in which parties would like to have a method of appealing other than the Federal Arbitration Act. Of course, statutory grounds for the appeal there are in Section 10, and they're pretty limited. So I think that suggests one reason, at least, the difficulty with appeal as to why there may be a need for appellate arbitration.
Okay. Do any other of the judges want to weigh in on, follow up on Judge Morris's comment? Well, let me ask Judge Pratt. Judge, I know that you, we've all done, and I know that you have done, appeals of arbitration awards. What procedures are followed by appeals arbitrators in these kinds of cases?
Well, obviously, arbitration is governed by contract, and parties can structure their own agreement setting out how an appeal is to be handled. But CPR has a procedure laid out for an appeal, and GEMS does as well. And probably to explain the various problems and so forth, it's a good idea to compare them. This, of course, only discusses appeals from an arbitrator's award. It's certainly possible to have an arbitrated appeal after a court decision if the parties were to agree to that. But I won't get into that problem at all. Under the CPR setup, it's required that both parties agree that there would be an appellate appeal, an arbitrated appeal. CPR is a freestanding type of thing in that you don't have to have proceeded under CPR rules in the original arbitration. You can have an arbitration outside those rules and still use the CPR procedure. The arbitrator is required, however, under the CPR rules, to have complied with the applicable law in the decision that is being appealed, and has to have given a written decision with factual and legal basis for the award. Also, there has to be a record that could provide the basis for appeal. Somewhat in contrast, JAMS says that both parties have to agree. It can be an original agreement or post-dispute agreement, but the original arbitration must have been under the JAMS rules. If there's going to be an appeal, of course, there has to be a notice. Time has to be within a reasonable time. CPR says 30 days, JAMS says 14 days. Both of them require that the notice specify the elements of the award that are being appealed, and both of them allow cross appeals. With respect to the panel, obviously you have to have a panel for a decision. Both CPR and JAMS assume it will be three members unless the parties agree to one. They could also agree to five, I suppose, if they wanted to. Under CPR, the panel is to be selected from the CPR appellate panel of retired federal judges. Under JAMS will recommend a panel, but the parties could agree to have someone other than who was recommended. Who's going to manage the appeal? Under CPR approach, it is the chair. Under JAMS, it's by the case manager, basically. With respect to briefs, CPR has no page limits and allows reply briefs. JAMS limits it to 25 double-spaced pages and no reply briefs. With respect to oral argument, CPR says if either party or the panel requests it, JAMS says if both parties request it, or if the panel directs, but a panel can direct only in complex cases or unusual circumstances. Can the panel hear additional evidence on the appeal? Under CPR, it can if any of the grounds under the FAA Section 10 are claimed. Under JAMS, they can take good additional evidence if the panel finds there's good cause to reopen the arbitration. The standard review will be discussed next by Judge Malonis. The decision under both systems has to be in writing and be concise. Both of them say the panel cannot remand, the idea being this is going to be the end of the line, but it may affirm, vacate, or modify. With respect to costs, CPR says if you affirm, the appellant pays the costs and attorney's fees unless the panel orders otherwise. If the award is vacated or modified, the panel may allocate the costs and attorney's fees. CPR also provides that if someone seeks judicial review that doesn't result in vacation or substantial modification of the award, all the costs of the review are to be paid by the one who opposes the award. JAMS does not address that problem at all. Let me turn the page here. As to the finality of the award, initial arbitrator's award, its finality is essentially tolled until the appellate panel has reached its determination. And then the time begins to run for review under FAA 10. CPR suggests there may be additional provisions added in the agreement which might limit the number of appeals taken. One would be a monetary threshold for taking an appeal. Another would be a provision there would be no appeal if the award is unanimous. CPR also has a provision that if the parties elect to go by way of a panel appeal, they waive their right to ultimate court review, but they caution that that may not stand up. That has been addressed by the Supreme Court, and I'm not sure the final view on it is apparent at the moment. As a practical matter, when the appeal is taken, the panel has been constituted. There's going to be an organizational hearing, and each of these points can be modified by the party's agreement. Basically, of course, they can structure the appeal virtually any way that they want. I'm ready for questions.
Well, I have one, Judge. This is Scott Donahue again. What kind of record is there a record that's required? Is it required that they have a written transcript? Is it required that they have produced exhibits for the panel? How does that work?
As a practical matter, you've got to give the panel something to review. Certainly in the ordinary complex case, there would be a transcript and so forth. What the record will be would be put together probably at the organizational meeting or agreed upon at the organizational meeting. It is conceivable, though, that there is no transcript, there is no exhibits. If you're proceeding under the CPR rules, you couldn't proceed without a record that could be reviewed. But by separate agreement, parties can agree to virtually anything to submit to the appellate panel to make a decision.
Are there any other questions for Judge Pratt? Let me turn now to Judge Malonis and ask, Judge, what is the standard of review that an appellate arbitrator is supposed to give when handling an appeal of an arbitration award?
Well, it's by agreement, as Judge Pratt said, so you can agree on various standards. But the CPR rules, which are on the website and quite complete, the CPR rules are that the original award is appealed on the ground that it contains material and prejudicial errors of law of such a nature that it does not rest on any appropriate legal basis, so it's the legal grounds. And secondly, it's based upon factual findings clearly unsupported by the record, that the original award is subject to one or more of the grounds set forth in Section 10 of the Federal Arbitration Act. And and under that act, that we have the usual grounds of arbitrator corruption, fraud, evident partiality, misconduct, or exceeding powers. Those are the basic grounds. The JAMS grounds, they apply the same standard of review as the first level appellate court in the jurisdiction would apply to an appeal from a trial court decision. So those are the different standards that apply by the rules, by the CPR rules and the JAM rules. But again, you can agree on almost any kind of rules, I guess. And the question is, can you waive a further review? And Judge Pratt covered that.
Okay. Thank you. Now, are there any questions at this point for Judge Malonis, or do any of the other judges want to weigh in on this issue?
This is Judge Pratt. I have a question. Under the JAMS standard of the level of review provided by the first appellate court, if you're in New York, that would be the appellate division, which essentially can find facts.
Correct.
And review the determination all over again. Whereas if you're in the federal court, it would be a clearly erroneous standard on issues of fact.
That's correct.
It highlights the potential range that parties can agree to.
Yeah, there's a difference in subtlety too, because under the CPR rules, the factual findings clearly are unsupported by the record. Under the appellate division rules, the court can look at it, make a de novo review of the facts, and substitute its judgment for the trial court's judgment. Credibility, for example. We don't find that evidence credible, or whatever.
So that by having an appellate panel under the JAMS review standard, in a sense you can get six arbitrators to have reviewed the facts.
Exactly. In the real world, the appellate division is reluctant to really substitute its view for the trial court's view. It's not done often. How arbitrators would construe that is another question.
I've often wondered, though, whether that was not a product of the volume of work that the appellate divisions are asked to perform. They just don't have time to dig into the records and find facts, whereas an appellate panel would have that time.
It's probably true. You're right.
Well, let me ask Judge Webster. Judge Webster, how does the fact that there is a provision that calls for appellate review by an appellate arbitral panel affect the conduct of the underlying arbitration?
Well, I think it could affect it in a number of ways, mostly positive. First off, I think that it provides a measure of assurance comfort factor to those who are concerned either about the makeup of the arbitrator or arbitral panel in the original hearing and uncertain as to what kind of actions might be taken or not taken, to know that there is a basis for a more studied review. I think it incentivizes the parties to be sure that their record on the trial is going to be sufficiently complete to meet the standards of review, regardless of which method is selected. The idea is to keep it narrow, tight, and timely. And so I think that's a plus for them. I've even found in my limited experience that some cases are more rapidly settled following the hearing rather than go through the process of an appeal. It gets the lawyers serious about coming to a mutually acceptable conclusion. That's not often, but it has happened to me, and I was glad to see that they were able to do that. A tight record, a complete record, knowing that we're not going to be the appellate procedure panel is not going to be second guessing the credibility of witnesses or engaging in forays of their own. They're restricted to what kind of relief can be granted. In the case of those who follow the CPR rules, the risk that someone may end up picking up all the costs will make them particularly careful about how they present their case. And I think that's all to the plus. It doesn't have to take a whole lot longer, but it may, and the time can be agreed upon restricting the limits for appeal. And I think that having that avenue, if the parties are concerned and want that protection, pretty well thought out by the various services and facilities that give up, knowing the parties themselves can agree to something different.
Let me open this up to the participants on the call, either to ask particular questions of the panel generally or a particular judge, or whether they have any views they want to express or relate some of their experiences if they've had them on appeals of arbitration awards.
I have a footnote I'd like to add to what Bill Webster just said as to how it may affect the procedure and the arbitration. This is Judge Pratt. If the appeal is to proceed under the CPR rules, Rule 1.3 says no appeal may be filed here under unless the arbitrator was required to reach a decision in compliance with the applicable law and rendered a written decision setting forth the factual and legal basis of the award. So the arbitrator has to have behaved in a certain way, which I guess is good, although not always do parties want the decision to be made in accordance with the law. But it also says another condition to having an appeal is that there is a record that includes all hearings, which answers the previous question. You got to have a transcript and all evidence, including exhibits and so forth, in the arbitration proceeding from which the appeal was taken. So it has a very definite effect if you proceed under the CPR rules. JAMS doesn't have any similar restrictions about being able to appeal.
I'd like to add a thought, maybe a little avant-garde in a way that, you know, when you're trying cases in the state courts, I guess I can speak to this because I was in the appellate division, and the subject is, should parties be encouraged or can they agree to take an appeal to an arbitral panel from a trial court decision or a decision in the state court, in addition to taking one from an appellate from a arbitral panel. You look at the time frames involved in taking an appeal from a trial decision or a trial court decision. By the time you brief it and get to the appellate division and get it before the panel and getting a decision, you're looking at a year. And then if you can go beyond that and get to the Court of Appeals, you're looking at perhaps another year. It's a lot of time on some cases. And in a year or two, a lot can happen to the businesses that are involved in these appeals, and it could be very, very, very damaging to the businesses. But if you can take an appeal, you can pick your appellate judges, and you know that they're very experienced and reliable from their track records before they became involved with CPR or other groups. You can actually pick a premier appellate panel, and then you can time frame it. You could set it up so that you would have to file briefs by a given date, record by a given date, and have a decision by a given date, and it's finished. And you can do it all within a period of months, 6 months, or whatever period you pick by agreement. It's just a very attractive thing for businesses that want to get on with their businesses and solve their disputes. So it's an area which I think is very, very saleable and very useful to the profession.
Leo, you could also provide in the agreement that the panel would apply the same standard of review that the appellate court would have applied.
You can apply any standard.
Yep. You can specify.
Sure. That's right. Exactly.
I know that in the arbitration appeal that I was involved in, it was prescribed that I had to apply the same standard of review as the Second Circuit Court of Appeal would apply in the particular case.
Was that an appeal from a trial court judgment?
No, it was an appeal from a three-person arbitration award, and for some reason they for a sole appeal arbitrator to handle a three-person arbitration award.
Well, let me put you all on the spot. Assume that parties do in fact do as suggested and have an appellate arbitral award from a court decision. And then the losing party decides to appeal to whatever circuit or appellate court. What do you as the appellate judges do?
Well, you can preclude that by agreement. That's it. The arbitral appellate award is final, depending on what, you know, there's an issue, what the Supreme Court will do with that. I think Judge Pratt said that's an open issue. Is that right, George?
They did hand down one decision, but that didn't involve, as I recall, an appeal from an appellate panel. It was from an arbitration award where they had agreed not to go to court, and the Supreme Court said you can't do that. You can't override a right granted by a federal statute.
My understanding, I agree with that. My understanding in the federal system, on the Federal Arbitration Act, is that the clear philosophy is you all are big boys. You have picked your method. We're not going to step in and intervene.
Well, that's the, in my view, the proper approach to review of arbitration awards.
Has any arbitration award ever been affirmed or reversed in the knowledge of the panel?
You mean an appellate award?
You mean as an appellate arbitrator, or did it go beyond that to the Court of Appeal and then they affirmed or reversed?
Let me ask you the fundamental question. In other words, has an appeal been brought before an appellate arbitration panel and the panel affirmed or reversed the arbitration award?
This is Joe.
Yes, all of them.
We've had them.
Judge Morris?
This is Joe Morris.
I have sat
on three appellate arbitration panels, and in only one was there a reversal? And there was a reversal in that case.
And what happened? What happened to the case after that?
I do not know what happened to the case after that. I'm assuming, based on things I've heard, that it was accepted.
This is George Pratt. I seem to recall reading a case several months ago where there had been an award by a panel of three, affirmed by an arbitration panel of three, that went to court, and the court's decision refused to set it aside, and one of the reasons it gave for doing it is that six capable arbitrators had reviewed this thing and all agreed on what the decision was. So they used the appellate process as a make-weight for a decision they probably would have arrived at even if there had been no appeal.
In the case, the one case that I acted as an appellate arbitrator on, this is Scott Donahue, I affirmed the arbitration panel award, and I later learned from the parties that there was no appeal to the courts of that determination.
So the appeal served its function of making further resort to the courts unnecessary.
It did, and it's also interesting that the whole procedure was done in less than 90 days, because that's what was called for, and that included briefing. The briefs were already there before I was appointed. They'd already started the briefing, and there was one day of oral argument, and then I had a very short period of time in which to issue the award, and that was the end of it.
Scott, were you the sole appellate arbitrator?
I was.
Was the arbitration below by a three-member panel or a sole arbitrator?
It was a three-member panel, and they were very illustrious arbitrators.
And what kind of deference did you give to them?
I was asked to, in the party's agreement, I was to apply the same deference to the award as the Second Circuit Court of Appeals would have applied to it, and to use the same standards as they would use if they were confronted with the appeal themselves.
How much money was involved? If you can tell us...
It was between $100 million and $200 million.
When you say you're to apply the same standard the Second Circuit was, is that Second Circuit would apply in reviewing an arbitration award or in reviewing a decision from a district court?
In reviewing a decision from a district court. Other questions from the participants in the call, or to the participants in the call from those that are participating and listening in?
Just a comment about records. This is Paul Lurie in Chicago. We often use electronic court reporters, using internet streaming, not having a live reporter and not having a printed record, using a stipulation that the record will be the transcript that is provided on the internet, and it saves a ton of money to the parties, and by stipulation it can be the official record either for an arbitration or even probably could be the official record for a court proceeding. So that's just a tool that some of us use.
Thank you.
This is Barry Garfinkel in New York. The question I have to the entire panel is how many CPR cases are the records of where an appellate procedure was used in CPR or in JAMS? Does anybody know?
I certainly don't.
I don't either.
I know of at least three, excluding Wellington appeals.
This is Mark Haddad. my question is, in the instances where an arbitration appellate panel was used following a proceeding in federal or state court, I take it the parties reached the decision to arbitrate the appeal after having concluded the proceedings in the trial court. And, you know, if so, do you have any sense of what, other than the timing issues, drove that and how difficult or easy it was for them to get agreement on things like the standard of review, which obviously is going to be hugely important for the prospects of the appellant, whoever that turns out to be?
This is George Pratt. I do not know of any case where that has been done. I just haven't had any contact with him or have read any. I only recognize it as a theoretical possibility.
I don't know of any either, Leo Malonis.
This is Scott Donahue. Nor do I. It's all cases I know about are appeals of arbitration awards, not court decisions.
This is Joe Morris. I agree. That's been my experience.
Mine too, Webster.
This is Dick Saylor. Is the disclosure process for the appellate arbitrators identical to that in the arbitration itself?
Yes, it is.
For CPR, it is, definitely.
Yes.
If I had a friend who had a client that was disappointed with the outcome of a trial, even a jury trial, let's say, would CPR, assuming the parties agreed to do so, would CPR accept appellate arbitration at that point so that what was being arbitrated at the appellate level was, in fact, a trial court award?
If the parties agree to that,
yes,
with whatever risks that they are taking in doing so, we would appoint an appellate panel.
Well, I mean, one of the judges made the very good point earlier that, and this is, of course, a great advantage of arbitration, is you can pick your judges. It would be preferable, it seems to me, for a lawyer who had tried a complex case and maybe won some issues and lost some issues to pick an illustrious panel as opposed to risking the wheel.
Yeah, that's the whole point I was making before, and you know you're going to get very sophisticated people. And if you have a particular dispute where you have two important business decisions that rely upon the outcome of a case, and it's really of great economic significance, you don't want to spin the wheel, and you don't want to spend 2 years wasting time and litigating it. And by the time you get a final decision, whatever asset you're trying to develop may be dissipated or the opportunity may be gone. You don't have the time for it.
One other question for the judges. Do you ever find yourselves reviewing in an appellate arbitration the application of the arbitration rules themselves by the panel below? Or is that pretty much never an issue?
I don't understand the question.
Well, I mean, you could say that the panel committed substantive error, but you could also say that it committed procedural error, i.e., excluding or limiting evidence or pre-hearing exchange of information, etc. So I'm really asking, do you ever face the procedural kinds of error associated with a violation of either the CPR rules or the discretion awarded the panel to manage the case in accordance with the spirit of the rules?
I would think that would depend upon the standard of review that the parties had agreed that the appellate panel should apply.
I agree to that.
I do, too.
Yeah, it was one of the grounds the CPR rules, and I guess it may fold into this, based upon factual findings clearly unsupported by the record. And I guess if there were major Or the other grounds is errors of law, such as the nature that it does not rest upon any appropriate legal basis. You may be able to fold in substantial errors made in the rulings of the arbitrators into one or two of or both of those.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And under the JAMS rule, if it were in the if the arbitration were in New York, the appellate division could reverse the decision just for admitting a hearsay document or something.
And maybe for what they had for breakfast.
I knew there was a good reason I moved from New York to Ohio. And it had nothing to do with the federal bench.
Scott, I think you said that you had a hearing in your case. Was that the case for all of you in your appellate arbitrations?
What do you mean by a hearing?
An oral hearing on the appeal.
Oral argument I had, yes.
Yeah, I had oral argument in the one I did.
That's Joe Morris. I had an oral argument also.
I think counsel are very reluctant to waive oral argument on an appeal.
I don't think it's realistic to not have oral argument in any of these appeals.
Was the oral, but the oral argument, I take it, would have been by agreement substantially longer than you would have had if you were in the Eighth Circuit or someplace like that, right?
That was going to be my next question.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think mine was 4 hours total.
Which is another advantage, obviously.
Well, obviously, when you're dealing with arbitrators as opposed to judges, the arbitrators can give the matter the attention it deserves.
Right.
You get a customized result rather than just following the forms.
Right. Deluxe, deluxe.
Did you all actively question counsel? Were you hot benches?
Of course.
At the end of the proceedings, did you issue a reasoned decision, or was it merely an affirmation or a reversal?
Oh, it has to be a reasoned opinion. You just can't affirm. I mean, you have to have. We issued a reasoned opinion in the one I was on, and you have to issue a reasoned opinion.
That's Joe Morris. We issued reasoned written opinion.
This is Scott Donahue. They specified that the appellate arbitrator was to issue a written reasoned opinion.
Yeah. I think the only time the appellate panel wouldn't would be if the parties agreed that it should be just affirmed or reversed.
Yeah. That's right.
This is Kathleen Scanlon. I was just wondering, for those who have sat and done an actual appeal, if you had any suggestions for either the JAMS rules or the CPR rules in terms of tweaks that you saw in the course of an actual appeal that the rules either didn't address or they addressed inadequately.
In my case, the parties themselves had, they specified the CPR procedures, but they modified them to a great extent. And as to what the record would consist of, and the procedures that would be conducted, the standard of review, the timing that of everything, they specified, they pretty much customized the whole process.
Well, I think as George said, the CPR rules, this is Joe Morris, I think are a good set of rules, but they can be modified any way the parties wish to modify them if they can agree on the changes.
Yeah, I agree. The CPR rules are, even the website says, they're really structured for aberrant awards. I mean, putting in parlance, awards that are off the charts. And And of course, you can modify these in any way you want, but it's a tough standard, and I think they're appropriate.
That's why I called it an insurance policy for those that are concerned that aberrant award could happen under this complex set of facts that they have, and it gives them that assurance that they'll be able to deal with it in an appropriate and timely way.
Hi, this is Bob G. Sam. I have three simple, I think, questions. One, have any of you participated in an appellate arbitration where there's been ex-party communication to the panel? Secondly, have you ever engaged at the request of the parties in settlement efforts? And thirdly, have you ever been asked to consider including in your written disposition that this shall not be regarded as a precedent between the parties or a basis for later claims of estoppel, even though courts normally will not permit the issuing tribunal to determine estoppel effect?
This is Joe Morris. The answer to all three is no.
But this is George Pratt. The answer to one and three is no. But as to settlement, I had one where we went into the hearing and they asked us to wait for half an hour because they were in settlement discussions, and we agreed to wait, and they settled the case.
Oh, that's it.
But we didn't participate in the discussions.
This is Leo Malonis. I'm sorry that when I got on the call, I indicated that I'm fortunately, the good news is I'm in the middle of an arbitration, and I took a lunch recess, and I've got to get back. So I'm going to sign off now, and hopefully we'll talk again. Thanks to all of you. Bye. So bye for me.
Thank you.
This is Scott Donahue, and in response to the three questions, I would also say no to each.
Would any of you think that it was appropriate to have ex parte contact in an appellate arbitration? How would you handle it if someone attempted it?
Not appropriate. I wouldn't participate, period.
Absolutely. So would I.
Exactly.
Agreed. Well, let me ask the people that are on the call, how many of you have any of you engaged in appellate arbitration, and after hearing this phone call, would you be inclined to do so?
This is Paul Lurie. I work mainly in the construction area, and I think a lot of the interest in appellate stuff has to do with a lack of trust of the quality of the arbitrators, even though I know that in some of these cases there have been distinguished arbitrators. But in the construction industry, you know, which has a long history of using arbitration, more or less, you know, I think there's a trust to the process. I've never heard a discussion, you know, where people seriously were talking about appellate, you know, putting appellate stuff into pre-dispute construction contracts. You know, I think, you know, general commercial stuff where the industry may not have a history of trusting the process, you know, may generate more interest in this kind of process. And certainly the amount of money that's involved also, you know, may spark an interest. So that's my comment.
Yeah, this is David Burt at DuPont. The answer is no, we haven't had an appellate arbitration, but I would say that, you know, first of all, I generally favor finality of an arbitration, but to the extent that you're going to go further, my one experience not long ago with a vacatur action convinces me that particularly where it may be an impediment to contracting, in use of arbitration during contracting, that there is no appeal I'd really be very inclined to design in an appropriate arbitral practice in the contract.
It's Dick Saylor. I guess if I had a client that was doing a, you know, sort of a bet the company commercial deal, a joint venture or something like that, and the risks of breakdown were perceived as real, I might do a, I might try to reach agreement at the contracting stage to have one arbitrator, maybe even name the arbitrator, but certainly specify in great detail the kind of expertise I wanted the initial arbitrator to have, and then build in an appellate process so I could say to my client's management, you know, this one guy's decision is not the be-all and end-all. We can still get a very distinguished panel. But I think that there's a high probability that you will be satisfied with the sole arbitrator's decision because we're specifying levels of experience and familiarity with the subject matter. But I've always paid a lot of attention to the way I write my arbitration clauses, and a lot of people don't, and a lot of people just use the, you know, the model clauses. But that would substantially reduce the cost of the initial arbitration, particularly if it's a lengthy one that's going to involve more than a week or two of hearings. By having one arbitrator rather than another, and to have the appeal be streamlined and relatively prompt, as described by the judges, would be a very appealing process, I think.
Does the presence of an appellate provision in the arbitration agreement have an impact, do you think, on not only on the care and attention that the first-level arbitrators or single arbitrator brings to the material, but also on, you know, the length of the proceedings and the amount of record material that gets developed? Nobody wants to be, presumably, the arbitrator who gets reversed on appeal.
I don't.
I think most arbitrators just try to do the right thing without much concern as to whether they would be reversed.
I share that view. This is Joe Morris. I share that view. And I am curious, in connection with the survey that I mentioned that was sent to the Fortune 1000 companies, there is a substantial number of people in the corporate and commercial area where they do arbitrations. In those cases, they object to the results on the grounds that the arbitration award results in compromise outcomes. That has not been my experience at all. I think arbitrators on the cases that I've been involved in invariably call the shots the way they see them. They don't call the shots based on whether a compromise is a desirable thing.
This is Dick Saylor. I agree with that, and I will advance a heretical view as to why that is. I think arbitration got the split the baby bad reputation back in the days before the AAA did their purge of the arbitration panels and cut the number of people they had available to serve from, I don't know what it was. It was the order of magnitude was like they cut it from 8,000 or 9,000 down to about 2,000. But I think one of the reasons for that purge was precisely that many of the users felt they were getting compromise results when they were inappropriate. And they aren't appropriate most of the time. There is usually a winner and a loser.
Yeah, this is David Byrd again from DuPont. Judge Morris, I agree with you. We haven't had that experience. I think, you know, while maybe split the baby results happen, I think it's largely a myth based on our experience.
Well, I think
that's still around.
I think 15 or 20 years ago, that you wouldn't be able to say that, David.
That's probably right.
For those of you who were involved in appeal procedures, how much would you say the entire appeal procedure cost the party?
Good question.
Well, this is Scott Donahue. It's easy for me to answer that because I was the only one involved, and so I know exactly what it cost. And because it was such a streamlined procedure, and because the parties agreed on what the record would consist of, and they narrowed it down to the exhibits that they thought were important, and they didn't have me read the entire exhibit record. And there was a transcript, of course, and it was a two-week hearing transcript. But even with that and the briefs, and then the one day of hearings, which totaled 4 hours, but had to travel to New York to have the hearing. I'm from Palo Alto. The total cost was about $25,000.
And what would you estimate that their legal spend was?
You know, that's hard to do, but I would say that they pretty much, you know, the briefing schedule prescribed the page limits. And I think they were fairly familiar with it. It's hard, and I don't know what the lawyers' rates were. And when I appeared at the hearing, there was one partner, one associate for each side. So I don't think it was terribly expensive. I would guess that for the whole thing, probably $75,000, maybe $100,000, including my fees and their fees and costs.
I don't have the impression that it's automatic that just because the right of appeal is there, that there's going to be an appeal. It's the comfort level is knowing that if things don't go well, you can take an appeal. But I just don't have the impression that that added cost is necessarily always going to be there.
I think that's right.
This is Paul Freeling in Chicago. Could I ask whether the judges would be agreeable to a procedure where each party?
Sure.
They agreed to it.
And would you have problems with ex parte communications between the client, one client, and the arbitrator that client selected?
This is Joe Morris. I would, yes.
I would think any ex parte communications would stop once the panel was sworn in.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it would work just the way it does with party-appointed arbitrators at the beginning stage.
Right.
You don't talk about the merits, you just talk about the merits of a potential chair.
I would.
This is Michael Oberman in New York. Say we come through this appellate process and there's an award that's been affirmed within the arbitration system and someone wants a judgment on the award. What's the court supposed to do under the standards for reviewing awards with this kind of structure? Where does it look for error? Where does it look for partiality, etc.?
I mean, as to whether it was the appellate panel that was partial or the
original
panel?
Right. Then does the presence of the presence of an appellate panel somehow could shelter what happened below, particularly if the arbitral appeal panel is presented with the types of issues that would ordinarily await a vacatur proceeding in court?
That's a very interesting question, particularly if the Section 10 issues were litigated before the appellate panel. The appellate panel found there were no Section 10 violations. Excuse me. Then the court, I suppose, would have to apply its review on the Section 10 issues of what the appellate panel did. But if the Section 10 issues were not raised before the appellate panel, and the question were whether the initial panel violated Section 10, I guess the court would have to look at that, unless it found that the issue had been waived by not raising it on the arbitration appeal. As I say, it's an interesting question.
I believe that our time is up, so I would like to thank the panelists for their full and frank discussion, and invite you all in about 3 months' time to our next topic call. If you have any suggestions as to which topics we should look at, please shoot me an email, and we look forward to seeing you then. Thank you so much, and thank you to all of our panelists today.
You're very welcome.